Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellacast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 16, 2016, and this is show number 597. We're getting pretty close to that 600th show, but we better dig into this one now. Well, Bart Bouchatz is back with installment 23 of his Programming by Stealth series over on Chit Chat Across the Pond. Last time we learned how to change what elements on a web page looked like, but this time we learned how to actually create these elements and then change what they do. He's using a real-world example of changing whether links on a web page open in a new tab or replace the existing page. If we're good and we do our homework, next time we're going to actually build a clock. Now, he picked this example because the clock on podfeet.com/live broke when we went to HTTPS. And without that clock, nobody knows when it's 5 o'clock at my house and therefore time for the live show. This is a really fun episode that we just did on Chit Chat Across the Pond. So don't forget to subscribe to Chit Chat Across the Pond in your podcatcher of choice. This week, something truly disturbing happened with my Apple ID. It all started this week when I used my iPad Pro to buy a Hue Hub from the Apple Store using Apple Pay. When prompted, I happily put my finger on Touch ID and the website confirmed that my payment had been accepted. A few minutes later, I got a confirmation that my order was being prepared. It included an order number, and I'll give you the ending number because I'm going to refer to it. It was order number 9168. In the morning when I got up, I had an email from Apple entitled Action Required. And it referenced that same order number, 9168. In the email, they politely explained that my credit card provider had declined payment. In the email was a link to order status that I was encouraged to click to verify my payment. Now, I'm not one to click links in emails, but clearly I knew by the order number and everything this really was my order, so I clicked away. When I got to order status, the Hue Hub was not in the list of orders. I could see the watch band I had bought recently, but not the most recent order. That was kind of weird. So I went back to the original happy confirmation order I'd gotten the night before, and I clicked on the order number from there. It directed me into the Apple website, showing me the Hue Hub order 9168. Above the order, though, it had a bright colored banner with words explaining that my order was not complete because of a problem with billing. It suggested I click a button to fix it. When I clicked that button, that's when I knew something very odd was going on, because the next page told me that my Apple ID was not associated with that order. And then it told me to log in again. I repeated these steps 3 times, thinking I must be missing something, pushing the wrong button, but I simply couldn't get out of this loop. I called AppleCare, remember I told you that's my new hobby, and I got through to technical specialist Christopher and later Keith, who talked to the sales side. I told them I didn't want to talk to sales directly unless they were on the phone, because this sure smelled like a technical problem to me. Keith talked to sales, and sales told him that my card was being rejected. Keith suggested that I go into appleid.apple.com and check my credit card. He did screen sharing with me so he could watch, and he showed me how to pause screen sharing when sensitive bits came up on screen. We saw the last 4 digits of my correct card in there, but it didn't have an expiration date, and the CVV code was blank as well, so I entered them. While he watched, I tried to reorder the Hue Hub. When I tapped on Pay with Apple Pay, I was immediately rejected and asked if I wanted to pay another way. Keith got back with sales and they thought maybe I should just try another card. No, thanks. I don't want to use another card. They asked if I'd mind just using the card instead of Apple Pay. No, I want Apple Pay to work. Finally, Keith said that he really needed to hand me off to Doc in sales because he was sure the two of us could figure it out. Well, Doc and I chatted for a bit about the problem, and I explained that we had confirmed the correct credit card information. I'd confirmed that it was not a bad card, it was not an old card, it was not an expired card. At some point, Doc just happened to drop into conversation the last 4 digits of my credit card from the screen he was looking at. Except, it wasn't my credit card number. It wasn't a number I'd ever had. I keep records and 1Password of all my credit cards and even expired ones, so I was sure about that. I even checked with my kids on Pat Dingler's advice in case their cards got tangled in there when they bought their iPhones. We have a family plan with Apple and AT&T, so I thought maybe that was it. But it wasn't either of their cards either. I asked Doc how they could have a different number typed into his system than I was seeing in appleid.apple.com. He said he had no idea, but offered to type in my real credit card number. As soon as he did, emails started flying into my account completing order number 9168 for my Hue Hub. At the end of this, I suggested to Doc that he really should report this up the chain. And he said, sure, I can do that for you. To which I replied, oh, honey, it's not for me, it's for you. Doc did suggest that I go to over to feedback.apple.com and drop a note to Apple. You can be sure that I did that, and I gave them the full rundown. I guess the good news in this story is that Apple Systems didn't let me buy on another person's credit card number. The bad news is that these databases got mixed up in the first place. Now, I would have put this entire experience off to just, you know, one of those things, except I remembered a story Tom Merritt talked about on the Daily Tech News show recently from MacRumors.com. In that article, they said that users were reporting iPhones which became activation locked with Apple ID addresses that did not belong to them. Activation lock is that feature that ensures that people can't steal iPhones and then get Apple to unlock them. So the only way these people can get it fixed is to prove that they actually did buy these phones. According to the MacRumors article, this happened when people had either just bought the phones or sometimes when they'd done a factory reset. Now, my problem could be entirely unrelated to their problem, but it sure smells like the Apple ID database might have some problems.
Hello, Allison and fellow castaways. This is Mark Pauly with a review of an iOS app that I discovered last year and have been using ever since. The app is called EasyPill for iOS by BirdsCorp.com. Until recently, I didn't regularly take medications, so tracking when to take a pill was never an issue. But that changed last year when I was prescribed a number of medications and supplements. Being a geeky castaway, I took this as an opportunity to find a technological solution, hopefully one that involved my iPhone and Apple Watch. EasyPill is an iOS app that tracks all of your medications and sends you reminders when it's time to take a pill. This was exactly what I was looking for. The obvious first step to using EasyPill is to input your medications into the app. While it works on an iPad or an iPhone, for simplicity, I'll just be referring to the phone. You can create your list of medications either on the phone or the EasyPill webpage. I chose not to use the webpage because I'm not comfortable uploading this information to the web. If I had, I would have created a list of all my medications, doses, and schedule, and the page would have given me a QR code to scan with the app and all the information transfers to the app. I tested this method, and it works well. But as I said, I didn't want to upload all my meds to the web. Instead, I chose to input my information directly into the app on the phone. I wouldn't call this process intuitive, but it didn't take long for me to get the hang of it. Honestly, I think part of my issue is a good thing, because there are a lot of options available. How often do you take a pill? Do you take the pill the same time every day? What's the duration of time that you're taking the pill? EasyPill really offers a lot of flexibility to tailor the schedule exactly the way you need it for each medication, so it took me a while to get everything in the way that I wanted, but I really appreciated that I was able to create a schedule that was both accurate and useful. It's also pretty easy to edit a schedule if you make a mistake or change something in the future. Again, the process for changing it wasn't exactly intuitive, but once I learned the process, it was easy to accomplish and to remember. There are two views for your medication. In one view, your pills are listed alphabetically with all of the vital information. The more useful view, and the one that I use most of the time, is the daily view. It shows a chronological list of all the pills to take that day. An icon next to each pill tells you the time to take the pill, and the color of the icon gives you a visual cue if the pill is overdue or to be taken in the future. The most useful feature of EasyPill is that it reminds you to take your medication. This is accomplished with simple alerts that appear on the phone and a tap on your wrist from the watch with a visual reminder. The app gives options for setting up the type and frequency of the reminders so that the app can nag you as much or as little as you like. When the pill is taken, a single touch on the phone or the watch logs the dose as taken. EasyPill then records the exact time that the medication was taken, and the icon for the pill changes to alert you that the status has changed. You can also skip a dose or pause a medication from the reminders. When you finish a course of medication, EasyPill will remember it for you by automatically moving the medication to the archives. You can pull up the archives to look at the history of the medication, or move it back into your active schedule if you start taking the medication again. Another handy feature of EasyPill, though I haven't used it much, is a direct Google link for each medication that obviously connects you to Google for information and images about each pill. This is a nice way to remember what the pill looks like or learn about the common side effects and so forth. EasyPill not only reminds you to take your medications, but it tracks your progress in a number of ways. EasyPill reports how many doses and how consistently the medication was taken. If you input the quantity of pills you start with, EasyPill will tell you how many you have left and when it's time to refill the prescription. EasyPill will also export a med list that includes the pills that are currently taken or archived, a detailed medication information, and a dose log showing exactly when you took the pill. This can be really useful to have a complete history of all the medications being taken. Having such easy access to a complete med list is really useful to share with doctors and nurses. If you've ever had to fill out a medication list in a waiting room, you know how helpful this would be. EasyPill includes the ability to sync the app between devices using iCloud. In theory, this could be useful to have your medication information on an iPhone and an iPad. I say in theory because I didn't have the best experience with it. I thought the extra screen real estate on the iPad would make entry of the medication information a lot easier. I learned the hard way that this function isn't very reliable. I had a few medications already entered in the app on my phone, and I wanted to update and add a few more. I activated the sync function and entered the new information on my iPad. EasyPill proceeded to delete the old information and move only some of the new information over. I contacted the developer, who suggested that I needed to start over, and, oh, by the way, this function really isn't working very well. I turned it off and haven't turned it back on. I would normally condemn an application for this sort of thing, but I really don't need the sync function, and the application works well for the things I do need. So while EasyPill isn't perfect, it meets my needs, and I would recommend it. EasyPill is $2.99, and it works on the iPhone and the iPad. Oh look, it's time to take another pill. So until next time.
Hey, thanks for that, Mark. I don't know about everybody else, but I can be on one medication and I have trouble remembering to take it. So EasyPill sure sounds like a good solution. So to the blind in the audience, I did ask Mark if he would test it out for accessibility, and he hasn't used accessibility before, but he turned on VoiceOver and he moved his finger around, and a lot of the settings type things were just said button, so they were unlabeled. But he did say it did show the times and some of the other information when he went over them. So it might be an app that's worth working with the developer to get it cleaned up to have it be completely accessible, but I wouldn't assume it was completely accessible right now. Well, I think I mentioned on the show last week that the trackpad on my 2013 MacBook Pro wouldn't click anymore. I took it into Apple and they said, as I suspected, that it was probably a swollen battery. Not a big shock because I keep this MacBook Pro plugged in all the time, which they say is not the best thing to do for batteries. Luckily, I took it into them within 14 days of the expiration of my AppleCare. Well, I did take it in on Monday so that I would have it back in time for the live show today. I picked it up on Wednesday, but the repairs they did on it really surprised me. They did replace the battery, but they also replaced what's called the top case. The top case is basically everything you see when the laptop is open: the keyboard, the trackpad, the enclosure for those pieces. I guess that made sense, since perhaps the trackpad was actually damaged when it was pressed on by the swollen battery. But whenever Apple does diagnostics on a piece of hardware, if they find something else wrong, they're going to fix that too. Evidently, something was wrong with my EyeSight camera. I've not had any trouble with this camera, but they replaced it anyway. The camera is part of the clamshell of the laptop, so they replaced the entire top and bottom of my laptop as well. I'm not sure why they did all that. And then, for no reason they explained on my receipt, they threw in a new logic board while they were in there. I think the display assembly might still be the same, and probably the SSD and memory, maybe a fan or two, but every single other part of my laptop has been replaced. My MacBook Pro feels like new. In fact, it was so much like a new machine that it had a fresh install of El Capitan and no data. Well, they had asked me if I had a backup of all my data, which I did when I brought it in, and they warned that this could happen. I've been procrastinating on doing a clean install of my operating system forever. It's been about 3 years since I've done a clean install. In fact, this machine was clean installed, but 3 years since I'd done it. So I was kind of happy that they forced me into doing a clean install. My first step was to replace El Capitan with Sierra, because I figured, why start with El Capitan? Let's just jump in and do it. Well, I always tell people that I don't believe in using Migration Assistant because you bring all of the cruft and glop you've collected in your previous installation over the years when you do that. Think about it as like moving and not throwing anything away when you pack your boxes, or emptying everything out of the garage, washing, scrubbing the floor, repainting the walls, and then just bring everything back in and putting it right where it was. I suppose if you never add new software, it might not be too bad to do this, but there's a lot of stuff lying around in your library folder that you probably don't want to tote to the new machine. At the very end of the story, I'm going to give you some very specific metrics on how much I didn't bring with me. Another way I like to think about this is, you might go through and say, okay, I don't need this. I won't bring that over. I don't need that. I won't bring that over, and pull out what you don't need. But that's like going into your closet and taking out the clothes you don't wear. You've done that before and you don't end up with any new space in your closet. But if you take everything out and put back what you do wear, then you will find that you have a lot of extra space. So I'm going to go with that new path of doing my migration. So I knew I was going to move over pretty much all of my data, but I did want to set up my apps from scratch. With the Mac App Store and 1Password for licenses outside of the store, it's not nearly as painful as it used to be. I've redone my MacBook a bunch of times, not my MacBook Pro for the production for the show, but my MacBook. I've done it 3 times because I had to get it replaced a couple times. It was easy peasy. I've been trying to convince Steve to do this on his iMac for about a year now. After watching me for the last couple days, I'm not sure if you're ever going to see him do a clean install. So let's walk through the process, shall we? In addition to CrashPlan for my offsite backups, I use SuperDuper for my local backups. I'd envision simply dragging over all my data from the backup drive to my new install, and then maybe needing a few files here and there from the old user library and installing the apps. Instead, I ended up finding it very useful to boot up an older MacBook Pro to that bootable backup, because there was so much more I needed to do. And yes, before you tell me, I do realize that I'm tainting that backup when I do this. I tested the bootable backup before I gave Apple my machine, and while it was painfully slow to boot from that 7200 RPM drive, it did work. This was an essential ingredient to the success of my story. All right, so I got a clean install. What's the first thing you got to do? You got to install Dropbox, because that's where the 1Password vaults live, or at least they live at my house. Of course, if you install Dropbox, how do you log into Dropbox if you don't have your 1Password? Well, I have a lot of other devices, so I logged into 1Password on my phone, and then I was able to type it in on the new MacBook. I'm just going to call it the new MacBook Pro, even though it's not really new. We're just going to call it the new one. So once I got that done, then I could install 1Password and I was ready to get to real work. I installed Wunderlist pretty soon after that, which is my to-do list application. I did it because I wanted to keep track of everything I needed to do. I like to only install applications as I need them because I install so many weird things, I don't want to bring everything over. But as of the time that I wrote this up, I already have 49 applications on my list that are essential to how I use my Mac and how I create the show. I am not going to bore you by going through all 49 items, but I was really surprised at how many little tiny things I had to fiddle with. I don't remember it being this hard. My Wunderlist has 39 separate actions on it so far, and one of them is install apps. In that section, I've got the 49 apps to install that are critical to me. The most complicated thing I do on my Mac is the creation of the live show. There's a lot of moving pieces to this, and I've documented all of my configurations to get this to work. I launched my live show setup page, and I knew I had everything I needed to set up all those different applications. I use several apps from Rogue Amoeba to get all of the audio bits to flow correctly in the live show and for doing Skype interviews for Chit Chat Across the Pond. Audio Hijack is at the heart of this. Luckily, it's pretty easy to export the configurations. You simply drag them onto the desktop and transfer them to the new machine and drag them back in. I had done that one ahead of time, knowing it would be essential. Loopback and Nicecast round out the suite, and using my diagram, I was able to get all of those working correctly. Amadeus Pro is my digital audio workstation software, and it took me 2 days to track down this one little setting that makes it behave the way I like it. Not sure why I didn't write that one down the first time, but I took a screenshot and I've put it everywhere so I don't have to find it again. Remember the app I wrote for myself to add drop shadows to images? Well, I had a copy of it over in my applications folder on the backup, and at first I tried just compressing it and dragging it over to the new Mac. Well, that shows you how poor my memory is, right? I totally forgot there's a lot more to it than that. I thought it would be fun to go to my own blog post and download and install it from my own instructions. I had completely forgotten that to install, I needed to first install the command line to application ImageMagick, but in order to install ImageMagick, I had to install Homebrew. Once I got all that done, I was in business. Gotta tell you, when you forget your own stuff, that's pretty bad. Right around this time, I remembered that Apple would probably want to upload all of my 65,000 photos to iCloud again. I've never figured out why they keep doing that, but it was time to plug in my external SSD with my iCloud photo library. I started it on Wednesday night, and as of Saturday night, it was still running with 43,000 photos left to go after 3 days. Actually, wait, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday? Yeah, 3 days. Remember, all of these photos are already in iCloud. Joe LaGreca asked me over in our Facebook group whether maybe it's not actually uploading, maybe it's just really slow at comparing the images to see if they're already there. I added yet another action item to my wonder list to figure out the answer to that question. As of when I'm recording, by the way, it did suddenly finish. It was still in the 20,000s earlier today, and this is on Sunday. So all of a sudden, it did finish. So it didn't take the 3 weeks it used to, but that was about 4 days. Let's see, what else? Steve and I have nearly 300 DVDs, and I keep them cataloged in a beautiful application called DVDpedia. I remember from the last time I did a clean install that DVDpedia keeps that database in the User Library Application Support folder. So I went over there to look for it, and it wasn't there. After a lot of mucking about, I remembered that the last time when I couldn't find it and I'd forgotten about it, I had moved it over to Dropbox to make it easier to find. Finally, I can see all of my lovely DVDs in my collection. I use a lovely program called MarsEdit to write my blog posts. I needed to configure it to connect to podfeet.com and pull down all of my recent blog posts. But that was really easy. It's just MarsEdit is a lovely application. MarsEdit also lets you create custom keystrokes, and I had made one for how I like to format inserted links, so I needed to recreate that. MarsEdit also lets you customize your fonts when writing. I have a particular affinity for the font Century Gothic. The last time I did a fresh install, it took me a long time to find out where I got Century Gothic, because it's not a regular system font on the Mac. I discovered that it's installed with Microsoft Office. I went over to my old backup, dug out my precious Century Gothic from the fonts folder in the system library, dragged it to the new machine's library, and I was happy again with my lovely Century Gothic. By the way, I did look online to see if I could download it, and it's $125 to download it. So maybe that Microsoft Office subscription is worth it just for that font. Well, let's see. I've created a pretty efficient workflow when I'm editing and posting the show, and part of that is enhanced by putting the apps I used in post-production into the menu bar of Finder windows. Easy enough to command-drag all of them up there, but I wasn't really feeling efficient until I got that done, too. Now, you know I'm a Hazel convert with a ton of cool rules that file away my scanned receipts and even more rules to move my data from my desktop to my Drobo and, you know, to keep my desktop clean and tidy. I had to go to the bootable backup and export all of the rules. Then on the new machine, I had to drag in each folder my rules were watching and individually import their rule sets. That was not as intuitive as I thought it should be, but it did work. I had found a place online that said where the library was in the or wherever in the library that they stored this information, but transferring it that way didn't work. Luckily, I could boot from that backup and pull it up. Now, here's another one that I forgot about. I take a lot of screenshots, and by default, macOS puts a giant drop shadow on every image. Now, you know I love a drop shadow as much as the next girl, but these are just silly size. They're giant. Off to the Googles to find the terminal command to shut those off. By the way, if you're wondering, it's defaults write com.apple.screencapture disable-shadow-bool-true and then a little kill-all system UI server thrown in for the fun of it. All right, a while back, I wrote myself a simple little automator action I call sleep. It does one simple thing. In Apple script, it issues the single command, tell application finder to sleep. For some reason, this seems to be an enormous effort to me to drag my mouse cursor all the way up to the Apple logo and drag all the way down to sleep. Instead, with my little script, I hit Command Space to launch Spotlight, and then I type SL and I hit Enter. Boom, my machine is asleep. Now, you're going to notice a recurring theme here. I had no idea where this little thing lived that I had created. I did some hunting on the backup, and I discovered it was actually an application. Well, look at me. I dragged it over, and now I can put my Mac to sleep quickly again. Probably one of the biggest surprises to me was that Google Chrome didn't bring over my bookmarks. I thought once I logged into my Google accounts, they would, but instead I got a much older version of them. Maybe the entanglement of having two accounts that caused it, which, by the way, I didn't try to have two accounts. Google made me do it. But I had to go over to the old Mac, export my bookmarks, and import them back into the new Mac. I don't have a lot of them, but the favorites bar has a couple things like the YouTube live link that I need every single week for the show. Now, another surprise that I had trouble with was Clarify. This is an essential piece of software for me, and an essential part of the ease of using Clarify to create my tutorials online is that I can connect the tool to my WordPress login, and then I can push them straight up to my site. That also makes it really easy to modify them later. I didn't mind tapping the button to connect to my WordPress site again, but I was surprised to see it fail to connect. On the old machine, I pushed the Verify button, and sure enough, that installation could see my server without issue. I dropped a note to Trevor at Blue Mango Learning, and he got back to me really quickly. He explained that sometimes a template or a plugin on a WordPress installation will make it hard for Clarify to find a file. It's called xmlrpc.php. He suggested I hold down the Option key while asking to connect to the WordPress server, and sure enough, I was then able to enter my site address and credentials, and it worked perfectly. Oh man, that would have been a bad one to lose. That would have made me really sad. Well, around this time, I figured it was time to start typing up my show notes so that I could remember what to tell you guys about all the stuff I was doing. But my right arm was getting a bit sore from all the computing I'd been doing. I decided to use Apple's built-in dictation for speech to text. Now, that's easily enabled by hitting the function key twice on the keyboard. But for improved accuracy, they suggest you install the enhanced dictation library. Yay, yet another thing to do before I can get started. It's a really big download. I want to say it's a couple of gigabytes, but I have pretty good bandwidth, so it was only a few minutes to get it started. I think it's quite ironic that I'm using speech to text to dictate into a document, which I later on read out loud as a podcast. Well, the most important thing in doing a podcast, even a video podcast, is producing good audio. When one of the most irritating things in audio is when the levels are not consistent. This is terrible within a podcast, but it's also irritating when you switch from one podcast to the next if the loudness is not the same. I use a tool called Auphonic Leveler to both level my own audio within one podcast and to meet the standard guidelines for loudness. A wonderful gentleman named Paul Figiani spent a lot of time helping me get it set up correctly. For some silly reason, I never documented those settings. I think I was lulled into complacency because the application lets you create presets. Remember when I said that using my backup as a bootable machine was a little bit dangerous because I might change things? I think in messing around and trying to find the presets, I actually caused them to be removed. I had to go hat in hand back to Paul and ask him for the settings again. He was a sweetheart and made a nice little tutorial with screenshots, which I now have fully saved everywhere. Bart has been teaching me how to manage my own web server over the last few months. One of the tricks he taught me was how to create my own SSH keys so that it was faster and easier to log into my server. I realized that I would need help knowing how to move those over. Bart taught me a really cool trick. He said that in the terminal, if you type open, and in this case, I'm trying to get to the .ssh file, he said type open space tilde slash .ssh, it opens that folder in the Finder. Of course, you can use this to open any folder in the Finder, which is pretty cool. Once I had that folder open on each of the Macs, I could grab the contents and move them over. Probably one of the easiest things I was able to move. Here's another one, and it's one that you'll appreciate when you hear security bits this week. I was on a Skype call with Bart, and suddenly all of those silly Skype noises started bleeping, blooping coming through whenever a friend got on or off of Skype. I'm sure you've heard this on other people's podcasts, but personally, I think it's a sign of being kind of a noob. I mean, if you're doing a real job here, I mean, come on, you could turn those sounds off. In Skype, you will only hear those noises once from me because I was furiously shutting them off as fast as I could while Bart talked. Yet another application that I've highly configured is my IRC chat client, Textual. I sent into several servers, the ones at Twit, Diamond Club for Tom Merritt's show, Relay.fm for Clockwise podcast, and of course, to chat.podfeed.com for the live show. By this time, I was tired of looking for configuration files. I just took a bunch of screenshots with Clarify, and I went back to the new Mac and did it all by hand. Steve and I ran a practice session simulating the live show. That's when I remembered that I had created yet another application using Automator. This application is called, quite cleverly, Live Show. When I launch that application with Spotlight, it opens about 9 applications at the same time that I used to create the show. I grabbed that from my applications folder and moved it to the new Mac. I also use an application called Moom to rearrange the windows to predefine locations and sizes. I have yet to be able to find that configuration file, so I'll probably have to move those windows around like an animal. All right, let's see. I also forgot to tell you one of the little tricks I had to use to move all these configuration files around between the user libraries. So we all know the trick of holding the Option key down so we can see the library file under the Go menu, right? But how do you see the library folder on a remote Mac? Well, I Googled it, and I'm sure you're going to be shocked to hear that I found a lovely tutorial over on podfeet.com showing how to do it. Oh, well, that really helped, though. All right, all I have left on my list as of showtime is to make sure my Paprika recipe library is synced, find that Moom configuration file, reconnect my CrashMan backups to this new Mac, copy over my MAMP WordPress installation, make sure it works, install the service for XKPassWD, use Migration Assistant to move over my Screencast Online users, set up a new local backup with SuperDuper, figure out how to get Excel 2011 off of a CD installation, make sure my home inventory database came over to the new Mac. Oh, and I've got 7 more apps I need to install so far. Now, aren't you glad I didn't walk you through all of the applications I had to install? And I didn't actually talk about every fiddly bit. Now, I figure by this time, 83% of you have decided that I'm nuts and that I should have just used Migration Assistant. But let me give you those metrics I promised at the beginning. The number of applications I had installed went from 242 down to 80. Now, that's certainly going to grow over time, and I'm sure I'm going to run into a few things here and there, but still, that's a huge reduction. I checked out the number of things in the library preferences folder. It went from 646 to 212, so it's cut by 67%. My library folder went from using 136 gigabytes to 12 gigabytes, okay? Seriously, there's a lot of junk in there. In total, I'm now using 200 gigabytes less disk space out of a terabyte. Now, again, I'm sure there's some more stuff I'm going to need to go get, but it's not going to be those kind of numbers. This has been a lot of work, and I hope I haven't discouraged any of you from doing this because I really, truly am a big believer in the clean install to get your machine running much faster and to recover a ton of disk space. But dang, that was a lot of work. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Mouchat. It's almost a chit-chat again. Yeah. Oh, it's so confusing. How are you doing today, Bart?
I'm doing fine. And the good thing about this is you don't have to figure out what show number it is, because this is a segment on a show where you will have had to figure it out by the time people hear this.
Time travel is hard. All right, what do we have going on today?
Lots of beefy stuff to get into. So let's start up with a follow-up. We talked briefly last time about a botnet made of IoT devices that took out Brian Krebs. And right. Basically, we all said that it's sort of heralding a new and very disturbing era where insecure IoT devices are no longer just a risk to the brave people running them. They're now a risk to the actual fabric of the internet. If you can have terabit per second denial of service attacks flying around the internet because of insecure IoT devices, the whole internet is now at risk. And the last story we talked about in this regard last time was that the source code for the botnet that powered this takedown of Krebs had been released. And that botnet is called Mirai, or I'm not sure how you pronounce M-I or A-I, but anyway, however you pronounce that, that's what the botnet is. And so that code is out. And actually, in the last 2 weeks since we last spoke, there has been a lot going on in that regard.
Yeah.
Well, because it's a big story, right? So it has continued to develop. So Brian Krebs has gone through the source code since it's been released anyway. Why wouldn't you? And the source code contains the hard-coded usernames and passwords that the botnet uses to spread itself. And then by looking at the documentation of different devices, so some of those usernames and passwords are too generic to be able to reverse. So if they're like admin, you can't possibly figure out what device that's targeting because that's just too common. But some of them are much more obscure, but nonetheless hard-coded, and they are reversible. So by reading documentation and Googling and so forth, he was able to map the password to the device in a lot of cases.
So he could tell which device it was based on what the login credentials were?
Yes. So basically, if a DVR has a default password of ABC or a default username of QX146 and a default password of, you know, W74G, something basically that's not admin, you know, something that's different enough to be unique, but it's nonetheless a default username and password, then you read the various documentation and you look for that weirdo combination. And then you can say, well, actually, this botnet is targeting this device.
Hmm.
And okay. So he worked out, basically most of the devices in this botnet were cameras, DVRs, and routers.
So hold on that for a moment. I was talking to Dave Hamilton about this on Facebook, and he was saying that it was CCTVs. Is that now yes, we know more, and it was more than that?
Oh, cameras, DVRs, routers. Oh, yeah, it's more than that. It's not just, no, they were targeting any device they could get their hands on. It just so happens that an awful lot of cameras are terribly secured.
So is it a true statement that in order for this, for the MirAI source code to work, is that they had to be able to get into the router in the first place with a default password?
That is a true statement, but it's not as reassuring as you'd hope.
Okay.
So, yes, this is using default usernames and passwords. However, so that initially was like, okay, and then the answer from the vendors was, well, then you shouldn't leave the default username and passwords on the devices.
Right.
So it's the answer from the entire security community is, yeah, you're doing it wrong. There shouldn't be a default username and password. Step one of setup should be, we force you to set a username and password.
and right? Hasn't that been the rule for at least 5 years we've known that?
It's certainly been the rule in terms of what is good practice. Yeah.
Yeah.
But not what these companies are doing. But it's worse than that by a long shot. So in digging deeper into the source code, Brian Krebs realized that actually it's not only doing web-based logins, it's also trying Telnet and SSH. And some of these devices have different default usernames and passwords on those two different routes in.
Okay.
And if you set a password on the web interface, you haven't set one on the SSH and Telnet. And then in certain devices, it gets even worse. There's a company called, I'm not going to even try to pronounce it, DAHUA. And they have there is no way to change the default username and password for Telnet and SSH, and it's hard-coded into the ROM.
Wow. What kind of devices do they make? Did you notice?
Cameras.
Okay.
So basically, these people are saying, oh, it's just because people are using default usernames and passwords, but they're actually, that's just disingenuous of them, because actually they have hard-coded in Telnet and SSH passwords that the users can't change. So these devices are insecure by design. These are just terribly designed devices, and they're going to have to issue firmware updates for all these devices is the only possible fix here.
Let me break in again. When I hear IoT, I tend to think home automation, but IoT is much bigger than home automation. Home automation is a subset of that, correct?
Right. It's the Internet of Things, and things is a much bigger set than light bulbs and
well, I mean, door lock. is my computer an Internet of Thing?
No, because it's a full-blown OS, so it's not, that's sort of a traditional device.
Well, a router runs Linux, doesn't it?
A router is an IoT, yeah.
Okay. So the reason I'm thinking about this is because when I initially heard about this, when they said cameras, I was thinking, okay, I buy a webcam and I hook it up to my router. It's inside my network. This is devices that are outside of people's networks?
Not necessarily, but a lot of these devices will have a cloud component, and so they will use UPnP or NatPnP to port forward.
Okay.
So they will make their way through your NAT router by opening up ports, which is why one of the first things I say to people is disable UPnP and NatPnP, because then any device can port forward. And so this false sense of security that, oh, well, I have a router, therefore I'm protected. Not if you have UPnP enabled, you're not.
Okay, right. I remember us talking about that. I'm good, you know, just going to write a little note to myself to double check that.
Yeah, and if you have an Apple router, it's not UPnP, it's NatPnP.
Okay. Everybody make their little notes, double check.
The easiest way to double check is to go to Shields Up and scan yourself.
Oh, I've done that recently and it said I was good, so.
Okay, then you're fine, because no matter how the port gets opened, if there is a port opened, you'll see it. So if you have a camera or something that has opened a port, if you scan yourself, well, the port will be open. if you find it open, then the next question is how, and then you're going to have to do a bit of digging. But if you find that there's nothing open, hey, there's nothing open. Great.
Okay, but just because we have no open ports now, if we had UPnP enabled or NAT-PNP on an airport router and a device later on opened it up, it'd be smarter to go double check right now.
Oh, sure. Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I'm not telling people not to double check by no means. But I'm just saying that if you find that there's a port open, then the real hard work begins. Then you got to figure out how.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm just remembering when I've been trying to get Plex working, and I remember mucking about in there, and I just want to make sure I didn't flip that switch because it smells like something I might have done.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so as a security legend, or I don't know how you, Bruce Shiren is just an absolute legend of the security industry. Anyway, he's been opining on this whole concept, and he's basically come to the conclusion that clearly the market is not working. Market forces are not sufficient to create a secure Internet of Things. That is obvious. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if market forces can't do the job, is there anything else that can do the job? And he makes the case that this is a like vehicle safety, food safety, safety, you know, air and water protection. We rely on government protection of all sorts of things where the market isn't the appropriate solution or isn't a functional solution. So maybe it's about time that the government stepped in to start to regulate dangerous IoT devices. I mean, they are they're just as dangerous as lead in the water. It's just different dangerous. So he makes the argument that it's time for these cowboys to be forced not to release this kind of junk onto the market. Okay. And it would appear that the European Commission, at least, is on the same page. In an interview, one of the assistant commissioners from the European Commission said that they are giving serious consideration at the moment to an approach similar to what we have in Europe for energy efficiency rating. So in Europe, every device sold here that meets certain criteria must have an energy efficiency test done, and they must display the results of that test on the device's box.
Oh, yeah, we have that. It's called Energy Star.
Right, exactly. So we have, there's a European version of that. I don't remember the name, but basically, so you always, as a customer, know how energy efficient your fridge or your washing machine or whatever is.
Right.
Well, if you do a similar thing, you can basically force the IoT makers to make more secure devices simply by rating their security and then forcing the sticker to be on the box.
Yeah, because that worked with calories. Yeah, we immediately stopped eating things.
Well, you mock, but actually it's much, much easier to be aware of calories in countries where clear labeling is clearly available. Like the UK labeling is the best labeling I have come across yet. And it's one of the reasons I love shopping in UK supermarkets in Ireland, is because the labeling is so amazingly clear and it's consistent across all brands.
Nice.
It's wonderful. I mean, there's a lot to be said for it. So at least the market has a chance of working when there is an independent third party rating these things on security. I mean, it's unlikely to be a panacea, but it's probably going to be better than where we are now. So that's some of the things. Now, to highlight some of the other issues, some other stories broke as well. So a Hungarian researcher went public with a laundry list of spectacular flaws in a whole bunch of connected cameras, again, from a Taiwanese tech company called AV Tech. And I just want to make the same clarification that Krebs and Security made. This is not the US company of exactly the same name that make environmental monitoring equipment. This is a Taiwanese maker of cameras, internet-connected cameras. Basically, over a year ago, the security researcher contacted these people to lay out a laundry list of problems in their devices. He has not heard from them at all, so he has now gone public, and the list of flaws is staggering.
This is a pretty big company. I mean, they make a lot of people use them.
I believe so. I'm not really big into cameras because I'm just too scared of the whole lot of them. So I can't really tell the difference between the popular ones and the unpopular ones. But, you know, this is an example of the kind of device that's being sold, right? So the config page doesn't check whether or not the user's logged in. It just prints out the current config of the camera. It is possible to download files from the device without proper checking whether or not you're logged in. It's also passwords are all in plain text. So you put those two flows together, you have a bit of a scary thing. It's possible to execute terminal commands by just popping them into the end of some of the URLs on the device. So that's remote code execution, made really quite easy. The device does HTTPS connection to its cloud service, but it doesn't actually check the certificate, so it may not actually bother. You know, what's the point of HTTPS if you don't actually check if the certificate you receive is valid? You may as well just not bother your backside. So this thing is just a colander instead of a device, really. It's just security hole upon security hole upon security hole. Meanwhile, Akamai are trying to raise awareness of a problem.
Before you go on past AV Tech, I just checked AV Tech in Amazon, and you can buy cameras from these people. You can buy routers. You can buy DVRs. I got to get me some of these.
Oh, yeah, they're great fun.
You know what would be interesting would be to see how much damage could be done to the company for not fixing this stuff if Amazon were notified about this. At least in the United States, that would cut their sales by 95%, probably.
Probably, if Amazon could be convinced to care, yeah. But I mean, Amazon
But it would be interesting if we get to the point where we have regulation that says you have to put this on the box, and then Amazon could say, okay, nothing below a 3 is ever going to be in our store.
Actually, you're right. That would make it much easier for every store, Amazon included, to just put down a rule. Yeah. And just say, all right, very straightforward. If you don't meet this minimum standard, we don't want you in our store. Yeah, actually, you're right. That would make that easier to do. Yeah.
All right.
So Akamai are trying to raise awareness of an issue that is causing them awful trouble. So again, this is IoT devices being used to do just distributed denial of service attacks. And Akamai hosts a lot of people, and therefore they suffer a lot from
denial of service. Explain what Akamai is.
Akamai are basically a company that moves bits around for money. They do CDN, they do hosting, they do...
I think they have a technology for distributed loading of data as well.
Right, so that's the content delivery network. They do hosting of various sorts. If you're a company that needs to get data from you to your customers, Akamai are there to help. That is their business model. They are data movers.
Okay.
And a lot of their customers would obviously be the... One of the services they offer is protection from denial of service attacks. So you basically put Akamai between your real web server and what you tell the public your IP address is. And so your public facing IP address is an Akamai address. And then Akamai filter out the denial of service style attacks. And in theory, they succeed at that. But in practice, that's often very difficult to fully succeed.
Unless your Brian Krebs.
Either way. Well, in Brian Krebs's case, Akamai failed completely. So I'm saying it's difficult for Akamai to succeed in filtering out the denial of service. But anyway, they do their best. And that means that they have to absorb massive bandwidth coming at them. And they're interested in figuring out where that bandwidth is coming from because it costs them money and they want to know how they can defend themselves. So they're always looking at how this denial of service stuff is being done. And they have discovered that if you take SSH... which is a very normal thing to have on a router because SSH is a secure way to log in and administer your router. If you don't configure that SSH properly, it can be used as effectively an open proxy or an open relay. So SSH has the ability to become a SOX proxy, which is something we talked about in Taming the Turmoil. And if you misconfigure it or configure it in a very stupid way, it can do so without the user having to be logged in at all.
I know you told us about SOX proxies, but what does this actually mean? What does this do?
It means that someone else can send data through this proxy, and then it will appear to come from them and go to its final destination. So if you want to do a distributed denial of service and you know of 10,000 routers that allow this, then you can bounce your traffic through those 10,000 different routers, and from the recipient's point of view, they're getting attacked from left, right, center, up, down, left.
Oh, interesting.
Now, the fact that SSH can do that kind of proxying is not an issue because normally, if it's properly configured, you have to have a working login on the device in order to be able to proxy your traffic through it. But if you have it misconfigured, you will allow anonymous proxying. And the SSH command to do that is SSH minus capital D for SOX proxy and then minus capital N for no login. And a sanely configured device should say sod off. But it turns out an awful lot of routers and stuff are happy to do it. They will just proxy without you logging in. So it doesn't even matter that you don't know the default username and password, or if the person has changed the username and password, the devices will just proxy for you. Wow. And
reflectors at this point?
Yeah, exactly.
Reflectors that look like sources.
Exactly, yeah. So the true source is completely invisible and the reflections are coming at you from every which way. How do you defend against that? You can't. So the SSH command is SSH minus D minus N. So they have decided to try get it dealt with. You should give something a name. So they've called it SSH Down with Showdown, SSHOWDOWN, with the SSH, the D and the N capitalized. So it's SSH minus D minus N. Okay. Showdown. But again, this is down to, this would be so trivially easy to test for if you were doing up stickers, right? Trivially easy to test for this kind of thing. So again, this could be dealt with by penalizing companies who do such reckless failure to bother configuring their devices. I mean, that's just careless.
This is one of those cases where you really wish you weren't right.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, because I gave a talk, about a year ago now to a Mac user group where I basically said the IoT is a scary place of all sorts of doom. And turns out it is.
Yeah, and you redid it on this show.
Oh, I did. Yes. Yeah.
That's when I added a third router.
Yes, indeed. And it turns out now that protecting yourself is only half the problem. Stopping yourself from being abused to attack the entire internet is now a new problem. I didn't even predict that would be how we'd end up with this mess. And also the US government are warning of cellular gateways. So these are devices used to make cars and other pieces of industrial equipment internet accessible. There's an awful lot of malware getting onto those now and turning those into bits of botnet. So all of this thing like Teslas and all these kind of cars that are getting attached to the internet, well, the physical devices to attach them to the internet are little cellular modems, and those have firmware, and a lot of that firmware is now proving to be buggy as all be Jesus.
Yikes.
So it's just, this is just a complete mess.
Well, especially since they're, one would hope that Tesla has hired the right people from a security perspective, but they're pushing firmware updates to the cars.
Yeah, which is good.
Really cool.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a good thing. So maybe Tesla's the wrong person, but I'm saying this whole concept of internet-connected cars, and it's not just Tesla. Chevy have gotten themselves, or Chrysler have gotten themselves into trouble with this kind of stuff, where they're having their cars remotely hacked, Jeeps and all sorts of things. So this is just a thing we're doing now. And of course, we have all sorts of pieces of industrial hardware that are connected to the internet for remote management, because we want to be able to manage a wind turbine sitting on a mountain without sending a guy up the mountain and then up the tower to go plug something in. Like, we want to do this stuff remotely, but we got to be careful how we connect them.
Yeah.
So all that's just a follow-up from last time. then we have a security medium, which I think is worth talking about, because most of the internet's hair went on fire, and I'm here with a fire extinguisher.
Oh, good.
So cryptographic trapdoors. I don't know if you heard of this story.
No, I didn't.
Oh, really? Okay. I sort of thought it would have made it as far as the mainstream media, but maybe with all the debates going on in elections, maybe we're not primed for these stories to make the real time. But basically, the headlines you're going to have seen about this, if you had seen them, would be about how the FBI could have secret backdoors in all encryption ever. It's like, no, not quite true. A lot of our cryptography is based on the fact that it's easy to multiply two large prime numbers together, but it's difficult to take the result of such a multiplication and figure out which of the two large primes were put together to make this big number.
Right.
And that's called the discrete logarithm problem. So given the big number, how can you find the two discrete logs? Really, really hard. And there's always been a sort of a fear that, well, is it possible to choose a prime in such a way that the resulting solving of the discrete logarithm problem is actually easier than it should be? Can you pick a booby-trapped prime? Or in other words, can you put a trapdoor into the prime?
Hmm.
And that's always been something people have been thinking, if that was possible, we'd need to start becoming a lot more picky about the prime numbers we use. But no one had succeeded in doing it, so it remained an academic discussion. Not anymore, it's not academic, it's now been done. So that means that if your cryptography relies on discrete logarithms and it uses prime numbers not of your choosing, then you need to be suspicious. Well, where do those primes come from? And could they be backdoored? Because the thing is, you can't tell by looking at a backdoored prime that it is backdoored.
Right. So by backdoored, let me say it in plain words that I can understand. You're saying, let's say I encrypt something and I've included one prime number that is known what it is.
Okay, so the attack vector wouldn't be quite like that. So the hypothetical situation would be that someone releases an encryption standard, say like Diffie-Hellman, and that standard defines a prime number that will be used within that is part of the standard. Then two people who are not the attacker are communicating using that standard with the prime number you have chosen, and you, as the third party, will now have an easier time to break their encrypted communication than you should have. And the researchers say 10,000 times, so four orders of magnitude. So okay. The fear would be someone like the NSA puts pressure on someone like the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, is the last T, technology?
NIST? Sure.
Yeah, NIST, anyway, whatever NIST stands for. So you can imagine that someone puts pressure on NIST to not pick a random prime for the next standard they put out, but instead, no, next time you're doing a standard, you're using this prime, okay? And everyone would then use the NIST standard, and then all of their security would be trapdoored. That's the fear. That's the danger.
Okay.
Now, this isn't a danger everywhere, because if you're doing something like SSH keys, well, you're choosing the primes on your server when you're setting up SSH on your server. It's one of the things when you install Linux, it'll generate a prime on your computer. So you're safe there, because only you are affected by, you're choosing the prime, so the issue doesn't exist. Similarly, if I'm getting an HTTPS certificate for my website, well, I choose the private key, which I then get signed by a certificate authority. So the prime is in my control, not the control of a third party. So those kind of things are not affected by this. However, Diffie-Hellman key exchange is kind of a common thing, and Diffie-Hellman does rely on hard-coded primes. So going forward, what needs to happen is two things. So in the short term, there's a really easy fix for this. What this does is it takes 102 4-bit encryption from probably safe to probably not safe. But the thing is, we've been turning ourselves off 102 4-bit encryption for quite a while and moving to 2048-bit encryption. So we just need to continue to do that and perhaps accelerate that. Get away from 102 4-bit crypto. It's now definitely not okay. But 2048 is still absolutely hunky-dory fine. Four orders of magnitude is nowhere near enough to threaten 2048 bits.
Oh, okay. So it's not that that same thing couldn't happen, but it just makes it still phenomenally improbable that you could get it. Okay.
Exactly, because it's not a back door, it's a trap door. So it basically makes it easier, but if you make the key really long, easier is still okay. So you have just gone from taking 5 million times the age of the universe to 4 million times the age of the universe. Yeah, okay, right. We're still fine. So, yeah, so there is defense in length. So 2048 bits solves the problem in the short term, and that's easy to do. Then in the longer term, we just need to be aware. We need to bear in mind that the next time a new standard is released and it contains a predefined prime, that's part of the standard, so a standardized prime or a magic number, then the question has to be, prove to me that that prime was derived at in a reasonable way. And I've already heard a number of techniques described for how you could do that. So one technique I heard was that you're going to take the prime must have the first 100 bits from pi, and then you randomly generate the rest until it's prime. Well, you can't trapdoor that because you've already set a massive criteria on that. So that's a technique. Another technique would be to say, we're going to use this pseudo-random number generator with this seed, and then you actually don't know what will fall out because it's the whole point of a PRNG. So again, there are ways to be upfront about where your prime came from so that we can be sure we can be confident it's not trapdoored. So we just need to think, next time a new standard comes out, we need to look at the primes. So that's not the end of the world. That's just a case of, okay, noted, we need to be aware of this. So in the short term, don't trust 124-bit encryption. In the long term, be more careful about our standards.
You mean 1024?
What did I say?
124.
No, there's a zero in there. There's definitely a zero.
Well, you shouldn't trust that 124-bit encryption either.
No, absolutely, positively not.
No, I think I see why this one wasn't in the mainstream media, because I'm not sure I followed all of it. How does somebody like a Nosilla Castaway not trust 1024-bit encryption? We're never in a position to be asked that question, are we?
You're not really, to be honest. It's up to the browser manufacturers to start deprecating it. So right now what happens is, so let's say someone goes to podfi.com. You have an SSL certificate, which is the prime of your choosing, so that's not vulnerable. What happens is that's really difficult asymmetric crypto. It's hard on the CPU. It's hard work. So you use the asymmetric crypto to start the conversation, and then you use Diffie-Hellman key exchange to negotiate a symmetric cipher. And once you're using Diffie-Hellman, that's the point where you start getting into trouble, because Diffie-Hellman has magic has primes predefined in the standard. So if the browser allowed 124-bit crypto and the server allowed 124-bit crypto, then they could negotiate that and then you'd have weaker crypto. But at the end of the day, you as a user never chose that. So really, it comes down to Firefox, Safari, all these things, the operating systems just deciding to stop supporting 1024.
Okay.
And people who run websites should configure them so that they don't offer weak crypto.
All right.
So if you go to SSLLabs.com and it gives you a green sheet, then you've done your homework.
Yeah, I don't think I have ever seen green there, but I don't see bad things.
No, no, SSLLabs.com will do a test on a website and it will give you an A, B, C, or D.
Right,
and
an but A I don't think green. I've ever seen an A.
ScanBartB.ie. It was an A last time I checked.
Okay. Well, I'll check this while we go.
Yeah, now the thing is, you always have to keep rechecking. So if I'm not an A anymore, I will be again soon. I'll just have to do whatever change the record. Anyway.
All right.
The point being, a lot of the headlines were FBI could intercept all encryption, which is obviously the kind of thing that will make people's hair go on fire. That's not it. There's more to it than that. There's a really good discussion on the whole thing on Security Now, episode 81.
Okay.
Okay, into the normal stuff. Security updates. Google have released their latest monthly security update for Android. 78 bugs fixed, 7 critical. As usual, the big question is, how will people ever get this update unless they have, some phones will, many phones won't.
Well, the new Google phones, since nobody's going to buy a Samsung ever again.
Certainly not a Note 7. Good news on that front. So Verizon have said that if you buy a Google Pixel through Verizon, they will patch the update. They will pass through the updates directly from Google, quote, much like iOS. This is music to my ears.
Surprised to hear this, because when the announcement was first made that Verizon was going to be the exclusive carrier of the Google Pixel, unless you bought a Google Pixel directly from Google, the internet was all abuzz of saying, okay, great, you buy it through Verizon, you're not going to get the updates. And that languished for a week or so before Verizon came out and said, oh, no, we're really going to do updates this time, we promise. It was just kind of weird how that rolled out, I thought.
Yeah, but anyway, this is good. Carriers getting themselves out of the way here is good.
Yeah. So
if phone manufacturers could step aside as well and just have a direct path from Google all the way through to the customer, then we're sorted. But this is good. This is a positive development. So I wanted
Mark
to point
it out. Mark me skeptical until the first update comes out.
Fair then point. Yes, we need to see this happening, but this is...
It's the right words.
It's the right words. Now let's see if we have the right actions. Patch Tuesday has been and gone. That means updates from Adobe, which includes fixes for Acrobat and Flash. And the Flash update is a critical fix for Mac users, not just Windowsy people. So we should do that. And also then a bunch of fixes from Microsoft. And the Microsoft fixes include patches to 5 zero-day vulnerabilities in Edge, IE, Office, and Windows. But the other thing that's notable about the Microsoft update is that we have entered a new era. The era where Microsoft would give you 20, 30, 40 security bulletins and you pick and choose which to install and you can untick any box and end up with this almost infinite possible variety of combinations of patches on a Windows machine. That era is over. From now on, Microsoft are issuing roll-up updates, which means they bring you up to a certain point in time, and you will have all patches up to October 2016.
So you don't pick and choose which ones you want?
You do not pick and choose. You roll up to the current version of Windows. And this should make Windows more robust, because especially with stuff like Windows 7 that's been out for a long time, this panoply of possible patches was a nightmare, and it would cause all sorts of stability issues. And how Microsoft ever managed to make that continue to work for as long as it did, I will never know. Like the number of permutations. You couldn't possibly test updates reliably if you allow this kind of picking and choosing. I'm astonished it worked as well as it did for as long as it did. So the roll-up is very much the way Mac users are used to things. We get security update 2016.004 or whatever. We don't get to pick and choose which bits of that we install. We just, that's it. This is your Mac is now up to date. You have it all. Well, Windows is now going the same way.
So this will be good when Microsoft gets the hang of how to actually do updates without severely breaking things. Wirecutter just came out with its list of the top webcams. And the number one webcam is the Logitech C920. The Windows 10 anniversary update breaks the C920.
Okay, well, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that's Microsoft's fault.
No. They've come out and said that they had disabled this thing that they knew worked on it, but they didn't think that many people were using it. It's not all webcams. It just happens to be one of them is the most popular webcam.
But were those webcams doing something technically against Microsoft's documentation? Because a lot of device drivers will do these kind of things that are not allowed by the spec, but well, there was nothing stopping you doing it in the OS, and now as OSs are becoming more secure, all this kind of bad behavior is being beaten out of them.
Yeah, maybe.
It may not be Microsoft's fault. So I don't know. I'm not saying it isn't Microsoft's fault, but I'm saying it doesn't have to be. Okay. And the other thing I'll say is this kind of a roll-up model makes it much easier to not accidentally break things. So the chances are this will make it less likely that they're going to break stuff, not more.
Yeah. Why?
Well, because it's really hard. You can't accurately test for the fact that some people may have this combination of updates installed, other people will have this other combination. Test that? Whereas when you have a roll-up model, it's much easier to do robust testing. And if you do robust testing, you're way more likely to spot a problem before the public suffer. So on the whole, this model, this is a better design. Whether or not they manage to execute on it is a separate issue. But as a design, this is more sound.
Okay.
So we shall see. Important security news. Apple are courting some controversy in regard to security updates. Apple are treating macOS Sierra as a security update. So if you have your Mac that's not running Sierra yet, configured to automatically download and or install updates, and if you have enough free disk space, your Mac will automatically download Sierra. It won't automatically install it, no matter what your settings are, but it will automatically download it if your settings are either to automatically install or automatically download. This is making some people cranky because that's a lot of bandwidth. It's not a small update. The fact that it checks disk space first is, I guess, a nice courtesy. But this is not how we're used to getting our updates to OS X. So if you want to change that behavior, that's very easy to do because it's just obeying your standard software update settings. So if your standard update, if you don't want stuff downloading automatically, you should probably disable that setting anyway. I personally have it. I've always felt that I prefer to choose when to download because I'm a podcaster. I don't want random things downloading. So all of my Macs have always been set to tell me there's an update and then download it when I say so, not download and then tell me.
No, I heard about this, and I suspect this is what the problem that Bob Goodrich in our Facebook group has been having, who, by the way, happens to be Steve's uncle. He has an incredibly limited amount of bandwidth. He lives out in the woods. And he just noticed that his bandwidth was just disappearing. And I gave him a bunch of tools to try to monitor it. But I'm thinking that this might be exactly what happened to him.
Right. So in that case, we may as well walk through this for people.
Yeah,
so if you go to your system preferences, and if you go to, I should have checked this before recording. It's either software update, it's either App Store or security and privacy. So let's try security and privacy. That's where I'd put it.
I'd put it in App Store. So I'll look there while you look in that one. Automatically download apps purchased on other Macs. Automatically check for
updates. Oh, correct.
Install macOS updates is a choice.
Yeah, okay, so
download newly available updates in the background.
Yeah, so that's what you do not want. Download newly available updates in the background is not what you want because that will download and then ask.
Yeah.
Which is fine if you have high bandwidth. It's a really nice convenience. But if you're living out in the woods, not good.
Yeah. This does explain, I know my friend Diane also called me. She said, okay, so Sierra downloaded itself. How do I keep it from installing?
Well, so, keeping it from installing is fine. It will not auto-install.
Well, there's a checkbox to make that start happening.
Yeah, but even the Sierra updater will not obey that checkbox. An update as big as Sierra, it always asks.
Okay.
Which is nice, because that setting it won't auto-install it, but it will auto-download it, no matter what your settings are. So untick the box, download newly available updates in the background, and then this problem goes away. Now, that's it. You've now asserted control over your bandwidth.
Yeah.
And as I say, if you have a cable modem, this is not an issue. You know, just let it download. It'll make your life easier because then when you click install update, you won't be waiting 20 minutes and then reboot your Mac. It'll just reboot and you'll be back.
Right.
So for people who don't have a bandwidth problem, this setting is much nicer this way around. But if you're a podcaster or if you have low bandwidth, then definitely turn it off and then choose when to use your bandwidth and what for. Well, Yahoo are in the news again, and it's not because they're brilliant. We have now learned that they created a bespoke email wiretapping service to monitor all email accounts in real time on behalf of the US government. And we've also learned that it has also been reported by people who say they're familiar with the matter, that the CEO, Marissa Mayer, decided not to fight the request. So this came in as a request from the government, and Marissa Mayer decided not to fight it, just to do what they asked. The Intercept immediately contacted other tech companies with the question, so were you asked this question and what did you say? So we have heard back from Apple, Microsoft and Google, and I think Twitter as well, a few others, and they have all said that they have neither received such a request nor done any such surveillance. And then Yahoo came out with a sort of a non-denial denial. The Intercept break it down, but basically they've chosen their words very carefully. Some interesting use of the present tense instead of the past tense. So I would, you know, there is Yahoo have said we didn't do this, but the reporting is pretty good that they did. So make your own mind up.
So there were two other pieces to that. One of the companies, and I don't want to call one of them out because I can't remember which one, didn't exactly say no. They said, we've never been asked to do exactly that. It was vagueness.
One of them initially answered with a very wishy-washy answer and then clarified later when everyone went, what the hell are you talking about? And they then later clarified and went, yeah, okay. So we've had a bit more time to... I think basically the person answering the question was a bit sort of like, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say.
Yeah.
And then they went and checked with their lawyers and then went, actually, no, I can tell you this is what we're telling you.
Okay.
So I can't remember who it was, but one of them was very, very wishy-washy and then came back later and went, okay no, here's the non-wishy-washy answer.
I heard the wishy-washy version.
Yeah, the wishy-washy one was really wishy-washy as well. It was like, that's not good. Now, what's also in related news, so I guess for anyone who's completely turned off by this, iMore have done a helpful tutorial on how to leave Google, or sorry, Yahoo. So how to shut down your Yahoo account properly. So
now remember, your Yahoo account is your Flickr account.
It is, which is why, unfortunately, I feel trapped.
Yeah.
I am, however, working on the assumption that everything I do in Yahoo-related stuff is completely public and probably insecure. So I guess I'm aware of it and continuing to accept the risk in a conscious way.
Now, another thing on the security side of this is I understand that the chief security officer wasn't told that they were going to do this wiretapping thing, that it was created over in the engineering side. He wasn't informed. He thought his team thought it was a hack. And so they tried to attack it, found out what it was. And that's when he quit and went to Facebook.
Yes. So
which is Santos, I think is his last name. He's my new hero.
Absolutely. And there was a nickname for the security team in Yahoo, the Paranoids. And basically Yahoo felt that we can't trust these guys. So they basically didn't trust their own security people and went behind their back. And their security people, credit to them, found it. And they basically said this thing is behaving like a rootkit. And also it was terribly engineered and full of security holes is the other shoe to drop on that one, actually. So it's not even good malware.
Now, I have to say, I've had this exact same thing happen to me. When I was working, was a different part of IT launched a surveillance basically on a bunch of machines and caused a distributed denial of service attack, and we found it and tried to stop it, and in the end we found out that it was our own company doing it to us through our outsourcer. In the end, the person who had launched this attack threw my sysadmin under the bus as having been at fault for why all those systems went down.
That's horrible.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. I mean, half of my staff had dropped everything they were doing to try to stop this hack, this denial of service attack. Yeah, it was awesome. That's why I like this Santos guy.
Exactly, yes. You're going to like Yahoo a little bit less now in a moment. So, Yahoo say it's not related whatsoever, but Yahoo have suspended the ability to forward email out of your Yahoo account.
Oh,
so if
no
you would
way.
Like to leave in an orderly fashion, tough luck.
That's
disgraceful. It's absolutely disgraceful. Now, the only possible defense, maybe, that I could make, and I'm now putting on my devil's advocate hat because I don't believe this, but I'm just making the argument because it's a plausible argument. I know from experience that the very first thing that happens when an account is hijacked in the modern world is that a forward is placed in it. So you could argue that because they have let millions and millions of passwords leak out and didn't bother telling anyone or didn't try to fix the problem, there is now a real danger of people hijacking people's accounts by changing their passwords and popping a forward on them. So you might argue that this is a defense mechanism to make up for their utter lack of security previously.
Wow.
Doesn't make me feel any better though.
Yeah.
So if you use Yahoo for email, you're trapped. Jeez. Which is charming. Good news, though. Documents released by the ACLU and Open Whisper Sync, A-I-E O-W-S, the creators of the Signal encrypted messaging protocol used by Facebook and others. They have released documents which show that they had been subpoenaed with an overly broad subpoena. They fought it and they won.
Oh, wow. That's
so
cool.
That's like the inverse Yahoo.
Jeez.
And just in case you weren't quite creeped out enough by Yahoo, they filed a patent for advertising billboards with cameras and microphones that will spy on passersby so as to better target ads.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yep. I
hear the Verizon purchase is going super well right now.
They're thinking of buying Verizon?
No, Verizon's buying them.
Oh, hopefully they see sense.
And they didn't disclose the lost emails. What was it, half a billion, I think it is the number?
500 million is half a billion, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't disclose that to Verizon because they hadn't told the public yet. Verizon is suggesting that might make a material difference, at least in what they pay.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
I would not like to be doing the due diligence on a purchase of
crash and burn.
Oh, sort of a warning to people who rely on Facebook as a source of news. Be aware that Facebook a few months ago fired all of their human curators of news and let the computers do it instead, and since then have on quite a few occasions been tricked into trending absolute horse poop.
I think that came out a while ago. This one, I remember this story. It was maybe is more about it now, but yeah.
It just keeps happening. Yeah, so that's why it's here again, because I think we talked about it before.
I feel bad for them, though. I mean, that's sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't problem, right? Okay, we were curating it, and they said we were being politically incorrect or politically biased, and so we'll have computers do it, and then the computers do it wrong.
I'm not sure if it's damned if you do or damned if you don't. I think they were doing humans are much better at figuring out what's fake. Maybe have the computers decide which to propagate and which not. But having a human filter out the garbage from the news would do no harm.
I don't know. The garbage and the news are hard to tell apart right now. I feel bad for Facebook on this one.
Yeah, this, okay, that is a fair point. The news at the moment is not.
Maybe in a few weeks you'll be able to tell real news apart again.
Starting November 9th ish.
Or not.
Anyway. Notable breaches. It would appear that a company who sell data hosting and databases have managed to. Obviously, they sell this to a lot of people because they managed to leak their customer database of 58 million customers, including their names, IP addresses, actual addresses, date of births, email address, vehicle data, and occupations, which is obviously a spear phishing risk.
What?
Yeah, I'd love to know how someone who sells databases can have 58 million customers. They're obviously good at selling databases.
Well, they don't anymore.
Well, they still have them, but the world does too.
Yeah. But I mean, they might not have customers anymore.
Ah, yes.
Or new customers.
Indeed.
Whole new flavor.
Suggested reading. Actually, strangely little in here. Just two, actually, I think I want to draw your attention to. A nice guide on how to secure the lock screen on iOS from TMO, Mac Observer.
The way you said that was how to secure your lock screen on iOS from TMO. Why is TMO trying to get into my lock screen, Bart?
No. The good people in TMO are trying to secure your lock screen. I'm sorry, TMO. sorry, Jeff. So I think that Apple is letting way too valuable stuff go through to your lock screen. And now, particularly with iOS 10, and if you have a Touch ID-based device, I think now is a great time to secure your lock screen because by unlocking the phone, you don't immediately go by the lock screen to your home screen. You still get to interact with your lock screen first. So now if you secure your lock screen, you're not actually losing very much. It's just the second it takes to secure you. So I would think, they walk you through the different settings, and I would say now is a good time to review your choices.
Yeah.
Because the chances are you brought them forward from previous versions of iOS where they had very different implications.
Okay.
And now I was always a secure your lock screen kind of person, but now I think it's become way easier to be secure and have convenience.
Oh,
so
nice.
Yeah. Reevaluate, make informed decisions, and maybe you'll decide to do exactly what you're doing now, but at least you'll have thought about it. There's also a nice guide from Sophos that I hope no one listening ever needs, but if you do ever need it, bookmark this one for future reference. It is possible that you will get nabbled by malware, or this encryptionware carry on, this ransomware stuff. And if you have data on Dropbox that gets nabbled in this way, it is actually possible to get it back because Dropbox versions all of your files. So you can simply go back in time and pull it out just before it got encrypted. Mm. And if you want to know how, Sophos have done a nice little tutorial on how to restore individual files or groups of files.
That sounds cool, but what does nabbled mean?
Nubbling a horse would mean sabotaging a horse before a race.
Ah, okay. Right.
So that's where the expression comes from. Basically, before it's been sabotaged, broken, destroyed in some way. Encrypted in this case.
Okay. one of them words.
Yeah, sorry. I like obscure. I like more colorful.
I like
versions.
Learning new words.
Yes. Okay, well, that's it. There's a few more stories in there, which are mostly, to be honest, relate to the hackery around the periphery of the US election, which is, I think, probably something that people in America should be aware that's going on. It seems to be asymmetrical, mm-hmm. But I really, really don't have the heart to talk about it.
That's okay. Well, I'm glad there wasn't too much in important security news, so we had time to really dig into these two follow-up articles. That was pretty interesting, but I appreciate the time.
Yeah, well, there we go. So that's where we stand now. So, how long have we been? It's been a long one, hasn't it?
No, actually, we're doing pretty good. It's been fun. Okay. It's been interesting. We're good.
Typing, then. My show notes are long.
Yeah. All right. I think that'll do us.
Okay, indeed. And then until next time. Oh, what was it I say again? Oh, sugar.
Stay patched and stay secure.
That's the one. Do what Allison said.
Well, that was kind of a fun ending. I enjoyed that episode, that's for sure. Well, if you haven't been over to podfeet.com/Patreon yet and checked out the idea of pledging a little bit to help the show, we'd really appreciate if you did that. Many thanks to all the people who are pledging. It was really nice to actually get some funding for the show for the first time in a long time. If you're still using the Amazon affiliate links, you keep on going with that because that is a great source of revenue to keep the show going. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. We got podfeet.com/Patreon, podfeet.com/Facebook, podfeet.com/Google+, podfeet.com/Amazon. And if you want to join the fun in the live show like Landon did after a long absence, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.